Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. February is Black History Month. Donald Trump seemed to acknowledge it as he did the Holocaust without the Jews. And he spoke of Frederick Douglass as though he were still alive rather than a former runaway slave born 200 years ago this year, who became the most famous black American of the 19th century, an ardent abolitionist and advisor to Abraham Lincoln, whose birthday is this month. No surprise Trump did not recognize Rosa Parks, whose birthday was February 4th, and whose refusal to give up her seat on a bus to a white man in Montgomery, Alabama, changed history more profoundly than Trump ever will, short of nuclear war. Or Malcolm X, who was assassinated by black rivals on February 25th, 1965, whose memory still terrifies white nationalists half a century later. And he seemed to overlook W.E.B. Du Bois, who understood more about the class divisions of race than almost anybody, and, of course, Fannie Lou Hamer. Pundits tend to think Trump is not aware Douglass has been dead more than a century, but perhaps they have missed the point, and that indeed, as Trump claimed, Frederick Douglass's influence is growing and will grow in the same manner and for the same reasons George Orwell's book, 1984, is becoming a bestseller once again. Yet for all the attention Trump paid to black history, he might as well have been speaking about black paint, or more pertinent to his crusade for white supremacy, citing a history of black as the color of evil, contrasted with white and Christian. It is wise to remember history as it really occurred, not as alternate truthiness. Otherwise, we have Donald Trump, self-proclaimed focal point or avatar of history. We are a democracy, not a one-man show, Bernie Sanders says of Trump. But Trump's ascendancy is directly related to democracy's decline, not its savior, but its curse, hammering at its fragility with blustering malevolence in a very authoritarian direction, which is a dangerous and unprecedented moment in American history, Sanders says. Today's program is something I wrote and read nearly every year as a tribute to Abraham Lincoln on his birthday. This year, he is 108 years old on February 12th. So I must give a disclaimer that what follows is an opinion that I believe is shared by Americans of every race and creed. And I am contraposing the most memorable and iconic president of these United States to the current president, who is rapidly deviating toward being the most reviled and untrustworthy. One thing can most certainly be assured: the land of Lincoln will never be known as the land of Trump. I dedicate this program to Rick Verena. Last year, he phoned me after my annual read about Lincoln and slavery to say that he enjoyed it every time. We never spoke again. He died on March 26th, the day before Easter. And also to Moldava Nimi, also known as Mo, Oregon's Chowder Queen, who died 25 years ago on February 5th, 1992. She was my friend, and I liked her very much. Maybe some of you have seen the scandalously famous photograph of her sitting happily naked in a bathtub. And now, the Emancipation of Abraham Lincoln, which I wrote, with a couple of quotes by Hope Tucker first. The United States is guilty of original sin, and that sin is slavery. And Martin Luther King Jr. There will never be rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. Abraham Lincoln, the 16th president of the United States, will be 208 years old this Sunday, which is also the day he was born, on February 12, 1809, the same day as Charles Darwin. He was murdered on Good Friday, April 14, 1865, at the age of 56, shot in the back of the head while attending a stage play by an embittered actor who thought his bullet would reverse the loss of a Civil War just ended. For most of the world, Lincoln is the symbol of the United States. For Americans, his worn, gaunt, and terribly sad face is our conscience. He is revered as almost a saintly human being, and with Karl Marx is probably the other most significant political figure of the 19th century, and certainly the most compelling in American history. Lincoln grew to power from poverty and obscurity. He was raised on the frontier and taught himself law. He is probably the nation's most successful politician. Just prior to his election as president, he was hardly known outside Illinois. At his inauguration in 1861, he was the most reviled man in the country, yet immediately after his death, he was regarded the most beloved. He almost single-handedly held the sundered Union to its successful and awesomely bloody purpose of defeating the secession of the Confederacy. More than almost any man of his era, he grew to understand the importance of the unity of the United States. Without unity, the nation would be the victim of other rapacious powers that wish to obliterate the fledgling split democracy and expropriate its vast spaces and incredibly rich resources. He passionately believed the doctrine of political freedom would disappear from the world if the United States dissolved. Ironically, his election as president severed the nation. And just as ironically, the division of the nation centered on the question of political and individual freedom of black slaves. Although Lincoln believed that the abolition of slavery was a political inevitability and the intent of the majority of the framers of the American Constitution, his dramatic act of emancipation halfway through the Civil War, more than any other act, made him one of the most memorable and important figures in history. Lincoln had very little personal acquaintance with slavery, though he had witnessed it on the river landings of Missouri and southern Illinois, and in particular during his single term in Congress in Washington, D.C., which at that time, in the 1840s, was a major warehouse for the slave trade, by then illegal, but not slavery itself. He thought slavery violated the doctrine of equal rights, but he never quite abandoned the idea of white superiority. For most of his struggle against slavery, he did not believe that whites and blacks could coexist without economic dislocation and violence, and preferred establishing colonies of former slaves in South or Central America, in much the manner as Liberia in Africa. He was opposed to immediate emancipation and initially believed that slavery could be slowly and patiently eradicated without disunion. He thought a policy of containment by free states would eventually strangle slavery. The secession of the Confederacy altered his hopes. Though he still believed emancipation would lead to catastrophe and initially resisted radical abolitionists, he needed a strong, clear, driving force to continue support for the war against the southern states to justify the intensifying bloodiness and appalling Union losses. He also wanted to instill terror in the South, which had always been haunted by the specter of a massive slave uprising. Yet he wished no revenge upon the South, unlike many Northern politicians and abolitionists, and his original plans for Reconstruction following the war gave no political power to the freed slaves in the defeated Confederacy, nor were they to be allowed to vote. Although he became convinced that blacks and whites would have to remain together because separatism was infeasible, he continued to believe the status quo had to change gradually if change was to be successful. It was his feelings several generations would have to pass before blacks were capable and educated enough to assume political power. Their chances for economic freedom were nil. And it is probable he was also aware that sudden enfranchisement of power and wealth would result in a brutal backlash against blacks in both North and South. Lincoln might not have been able to prevent the opportunistic revenge upon the South, but his death ensured it. Its result was a counter-revenge, not upon the white carpetbaggers who infested the South after the Civil War, but upon freed slaves who were terrorized and murdered. White supremacy groups grew up on the fringes of Southern anger, the most dominant and ruthless, the Knight Riders of the Ku Klux Klan. Lynchings of blacks were commonplace following the Civil War and lasted until the seventh decade of the 20th century. After nearly a century and a half after emancipation, the United States finally elected a black president. Yet, a decade and a half into the 21st century, the overwhelming majority of American blacks are still without position or power. And although the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s dramatized and somewhat improved black prospects, the pervasive racism that continues to saturate American society strips away the few advances that have been achieved. American history is taught from primarily a white perspective, which is only a portion of our history. And without integrating it with black American history, it is irrelevant, and worse, it is a lie that perpetuates the racism that underlies and embitters our truly pluralistic society and history. African blacks and European whites were parallel colonizers of the Western Hemisphere, and together they built the civilizations that currently exist in North and South America. The primary difference is that black immigration was a forced migration. Millions of blacks were brought in chains from Africa as slaves for four centuries. Slavery evolved as a result of the need for an abundant and relatively cheap supply of labor in the colonized Americas, and the traffic in slaves was itself probably the most profitable international trade in history. Entire industries were built on the commerce of human slaves, and as cruel as it was, which induced an opaqueness to the torment inflicted by the trade, the extent and profitability of slavery built cities and helped raise the capital that started the Industrial Revolution in England. Much of Africa was emptied to provide slaves for the European colonies in the Americas, and most of Africa was colonized by European nations. Africans who were not sent across the oceans as slaves were enslaved at home. No one will ever know precisely how many millions of blacks were killed in their villages in four centuries of slave raids, but it is estimated that about one-third of those captured died en route to the coasts or while imprisoned awaiting embarkation, and another third aboard ships in which they were chained and stacked like cords of wood in overcrowded, filthy holds, and during the seasoning process of slavery, worked to death in stifling climates, beaten and murdered if they were slow to obey or attempted to escape. When the slave trade was finally declared illegal at the end of the 18th century, its illicitness made it even more profitable in much the manner as the current international drug trade. And as with illegal drugs, when capture is imminent, uncounted thousands of black men, women, and children were thrown overboard to drown in the ocean, chained together whenever a naval patrol caught up with a slave ship. The trade was also profitable because it was easier to work a slave to death and buy a new one than it was to breed and feed newer generations, although that, of course, was also done. Slavery in the Americas took two separate directions. In the Spanish and Portuguese colonies in South and Central America, slavery continued the long tradition of Mediterranean slavery, practiced most famously in classical times. Roman slaves were granted not only freedom, but much prized Roman citizenship, and was incorporated in the Iberian Catholic religious doctrine, which claimed that although slaves were of the lowest social order, both masters and slaves possessed souls that were regarded as equals by God. The tendency, therefore, was that slaves were human beings with some rights and some legal means by which they might achieve freedom. The legal structures of the North American colonies and the British West Indies, and later the United States, did not recognize slaves as human beings entitled to human rights. The ancient and medieval experiences with slavery had been forgotten, and Northern Europe did not have a comparable tradition with the Iberian nations. There was no slave law and no concern for blacks in their religious doctrines. More problematic for the future was the tendency of Northern Europeans and Americans to identify blacks with slavery. The mere fact of being black was presumptive of slave status. Slavery was considered perpetual, and chances of working toward freedom were few. To be black was to be a slave, without rights to marriage, children, whose value was only as prospective slaves, property, or the product of their work. Yet, despite the differences of the slave systems of North and South America, they were only differences of degree. Wherever there was slavery, there was a slave society, not merely for blacks, but for whites also. Blacks and whites were bound together in cruel and bitter antagonism, but also in a complex relationship that could not express itself without reference to each other. It was a class relationship that became ever more defined as a racial one. North American Southern society in particular was enclosed and closed off by its slave system. Southern slave society grew from the same historical conditions that produced the world's other slave regimes. The rise of the world market and the need for cheap labor encouraged slavery, and only the advent of mechanical technology and industrialism rendered it inefficient and ultimately incapable of competing in the very market that created it. The South was haunted by its guilt and fear of slavery. Enslaving blacks was justified through claims that it was God's intent that whites were superior to blacks, that slavery civilized blacks and elevated them above their former status as jungle savages, and that, in essence, whites were carrying out God's law by making slaves and Christians out of pagan blacks. In reality, Southern plantations were battlefields where slaves fought masters for physical and psychological survival, and although they were unlettered, outnumbered, and unarmed, black slaves struggled in as many ways as they could to preserve their humanity against virtually inhuman odds. Southern whites bitterly resisted acknowledging the humanity of their black slaves, which was contradictory of their claim of God's edict to Christianize them. Underlying their pious justifications was a terror of the system they had fabricated. The culture of the antebellum South was continually in dread of slave insurrection, and any outbreak was savagely suppressed. In a sense, a reason for perpetuating slavery was the fear of reprisal once it was abolished. Most Northern whites also considered themselves superior to blacks, and the desire to abolish slavery had more to do with its interference with paid labor than with human rights. Even a majority of the Northern abolitionists, who risked imprisonment and their lives providing underground systems of escape for runaway slaves, felt, as Abraham Lincoln, that blacks should dwell apart from whites. Yet, ultimately, however intense the economic dialectics regarding slavery, and perhaps because the climate of industrialism allowed it, the most important reason for the abolition of slavery was the moral one. The idea of the inherent value of a human being outlasted slavery and was the chief source of its undoing. There were many reasons for the division of the young nation, South from North, but at its core was the inhumanity of slavery. Frank Tannenbaum, in his book Slave and Citizen, wrote that inherent in the history of slavery was an important contribution to the theory of social change. Wherever the law accepted the doctrine of the moral personality of the slave and made possible the gradual achievement of freedom implicit in such a doctrine, the slave system was abolished peacefully. Where the slave was denied recognition as a moral person and was therefore incapable of freedom, the abolition of slavery was accomplished by violence and revolution. Americans cannot separate our history from the long centuries of slavery. Without black slaves from Africa, much of the Western Hemisphere would not have been converted into an enclave of European civilization. The fight for independence that characterized the American Revolution did not include liberty for slaves, and the oversight caused the Civil War 80 years afterward. Emancipation only brought a semblance of physical relief from slavery, and its underlying racism has definitely not been eradicated a century and a half later. If the class system of slavery is defined by color, then a post-slavery society becomes a form of apartheid, which has been the result in the United States since the Civil War, and which was starkly dramatized in the violence unleashed against the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s. At the third millennium of our era, the U.S. remains a divided nation. And as Lincoln famously said, though he was not the first to say it, a house divided will not long stand. Blacks as well as whites wish for mutual separation, but there is really no other place to go. Just as whites are no longer Europeans, American blacks are not Africans anymore. For better or worse, blacks and whites are hybrid Americans. Slaves or free, the arduous, tragic, and unequal role of black Americans in building and defending the nation has always been devalued and generally ignored. Just as the word history seems to imply only male endeavor, his story, so does it also imply Western European white dominance and supremacy over world affairs. Yet the black struggle for civic and social equality, especially in the last generation, has been the most inspiring and closest to the revolution of the 18th century Enlightenment that gave birth to the United States than any other. This struggle is a continuation of what Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, the Adamses, et al. Started and unfortunately denied people of color, and that's a quote, who were regarded as property rather than persons, born equal, also a quote, and certainly not born free. Lincoln's Executive Order of Emancipation went into effect January 1, 1863. Though it abolished slavery in the Confederate states, but not those under Union control, its legality was doubtful according to U.S. civil law. To remedy any deficiencies in the proclamation in regard to its legal standing, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution was introduced in Congress in 1864 and was ratified in 1865, the year the Civil War ended. It abolished slavery or involuntary servitude in the United States or anywhere under U.S. jurisdiction. The Emancipation Proclamation, although it raised the conflict for union to an issue of international moral principle, had little initial practical impact because Lincoln, at the time, had no authority in the Confederacy. Lincoln had proposed the proclamation the previous summer. Secretary of State William Seward suggested he wait to announce until after a significant Union battlefield victory so that European governments would not misinterpret it as a final quote-unquote, shriek in our retreat. Lincoln had said at the start of the Civil War, "If I could preserve the Union by freeing all of the slaves everywhere, I would do so. If I could preserve the Union by freeing none of the slaves, I would do so. If I could preserve the Union by freeing some of the slaves, I would do so." His critics and some supporters thought the proclamation was a cynical act by a weak, vacillating president. Yet, by conceding to free the few, he struck to the heart of the conflict and never afterward wavered from his promise. He got his victory at Sharpsburg, Maryland, on September 16, 1862, near a little creek and a church named after it that forever gave the battle its name, Antietam. The Union Army routed a Confederate invasion of the North. It was the single bloodiest day of the Civil War, at least 15,000 dead on both sides, and another 20,000 wounded or missing. Union losses alone were twice as many as those on the Normandy D-Day landings 82 years later. 5 days after Antietam, Lincoln issued his proclamation. On the first day of January, 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or designated part of a state, the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States, shall then be thenceforth and forever free. If my name ever goes into history, Lincoln said, it was for this act. It took a century and a Southern president, a member of the party of traitors, formerly Southern Democrats, to take the next step of what emancipation began. Lyndon Johnson successfully pushed through Congress the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act of 1965. He said, 3.5 centuries ago, the first Negroes arrived. They came in darkness and in chains. The story of our nation and of the American Negro are like two rivers that flow through the centuries along divided channels. When the Liberty Bell rang out in Philadelphia, it did not toll for the Negro. When Andrew Jackson threw open the doors of democracy, they did not open for the Negro. It was only at Appomattox, a century later, that an American victory was also a Negro victory, and the two rivers, one shining with promise, the other dark-stained with oppression, began to move forward toward one another. And that was Johnson. But as part of his speech, it wasn't freedom for Native Americans whom President Jackson exiled to the far west and forced onto the Trail of Tears. And that's a bit of a note. But rivers of blood coursed between blacks and white in the United States. That same year of 1965, the Watts riot in Los Angeles erupted, and 27 years later, in the spring of 1992, the worst domestic riot in U.S. history occurred in the same place because white police, who savagely beat a black man senseless, were acquitted by an all-white jury. With few exceptions, American blacks are contained and isolated in urban ghettos in much the manner Nazis forced Jews into European ghettos. They are denied adequate education, employment, housing, or health care. In at least one disgraceful instance, water fit to drink. They are forced to subsist on deleterious doles, stingily appropriated, which are exploited as examples for abolishing welfare. Black rage against the injustices inflicted upon them is forced inward against themselves. The barely constrained contempt whites hold for blacks is probably equally felt toward whites by blacks who are victims of the antipathy, but outnumbered 10-1. Without the tremendous legal strength and firepower of the whites, they are generally unable to strike back without horrendous consequences. White-dominated police forces act in black communities as if they were foreign occupying armies. Most of the time, as Thomas Jefferson noted in the Declaration of Independence, people patiently endure the iron heel, but an excessive act, such as the acquittal of the policeman who assaulted Rodney King in 1992, or the more recent police murders of unarmed black men and women, can be the final ignominy that erupts thermonuclear reaction, which can be terrible to witness or be a part of. In both the Watts and 1992 race riots in Los Angeles, crowds rampaged the first couple of days and nights, randomly burning and looting. Police and National Guard responded with heavy firepower. Firemen were attacked and forced to avoid fires because of the violence and incapacity to respond to so many. Entire city blocks were on fire in Watts in 1965 and greater central L.A. in 1992, and similarly, non-black owned or operated liquor stores, markets, and other businesses in the black community were torched and looted. In Watts and in central L.A. 25 years ago, crowds of blacks mauled and torched their own neighborhoods, inflicting destruction and homelessness upon themselves and their neighbors, most of whom were trapped within the hysteria. Police fired into crowds of looters and other gatherings of blacks. The death toll of mainly black American citizens killed by police and National Guardsmen in 1992 greatly exceeded Watts, and in both instances, at least twice as many, and probably more, were killed as were officially claimed. So many blacks were dead and wounded during Watts that city parks became temporary morgues and hospitals, and prison booking facilities were set up in the parks because of the overflow of arrested black persons. The great fear of everybody during Watts, and surely also in 1992, was the possibility of a white backlash from the surrounding suburbs, which would ignite a bloody race war. Although at the time, Watts was the most severe outbreak of insurrection since the Civil War, 1992's replaced Watts, Detroit, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and Liberty City, Florida, as the nation's largest urban racial riot, greatly exceeding even the most recent urban insurrections. And all of them flared as a result of racially xenophobic treatment by police, to whom it seems apparent that black lives do not matter. an optimistic premise that these reactive acts of black insurrection are wake-up calls for the society to repair a multitude of gross injustices is of little reality until the nation as a whole resolves the bitter enmity between blacks and whites. The most consistent story of the United States is the struggle between whites and blacks, which was at the core of the Civil War a century and a half in the past. Not all whites are racial supremacists, though most are racist, if not intentionally, usually on impact. Yet although whites have fought for and some have died or cruelly beaten for civil rights for blacks, the prevailing white attitude towards blacks was summed up in 1857 by Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court Roger Taney when, speaking for the majority in Dred Scott, he stated that Negroes were considered so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect, quote, unquote. Racism will only end when the children of every race are taught early that the color of skin is far less than the quality of hearts and minds. That will not be easy. No less than the essential education system of the United States must be uprooted and rewritten to reflect the common struggle of both races to build and survive in this country. Then, perhaps, Lyndon Johnson's two rivers might converge. "We cannot escape history," Lincoln said to Congress. "We will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare war one or another of us. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation." Happy Abraham Lincoln's birthday. This has been Michael McCusker.